listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has a primary election coming up Tuesday, August 9th. It's a big election year with Democratic Governor Tony Evers running for a second term. There's a field of potential Republican challengers, and multiple Democrats are running to challenge incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson. While primaries, even midterms, tend to have much lower voter turnout than presidential elections, this week's leaked Supreme Court draft opinion that would, if it holds up, overturn Roe v. Wade has gotten a lot of attention focused on voting. Could that bring more people to the polls this year? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has your attention when it comes to this August primary? Are you paying attention yet? Are you interested in choosing a candidate, a Democrat to run against Ron Johnson, a Republican to run against Tony Evers? What do those candidates have to do to make you pick them as the one? Or do you not care? You'll vote for whoever is on the ballot, even if it's a Muppet, if it gives you a chance of unseating an incumbent you don't like. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Julia Azari is Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. Julia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with this draft opinion from the U.S. Supreme Court, potentially overturning Roe v. Wade later this summer. How do you see that shaking up elections, if at all, this year?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there's a couple of ways that this could go. The first one, which you've undoubtedly heard a lot about, is the possibility that this kind of galvanizes Democrats who have typically been less motivated by judicial issues and court issues than Republicans. And I think that's something that has gotten a lot of attention because, of course, the upcoming midterms don't look like great conditions for the Democrats. It's never really a great situation for the president's party, and we're in a situation in which the Democrats are receiving low marks on their performance on important issues like the economy, and Biden isn't very popular. So I think that a lot of politics watchers who are kind of either on the Democratic side or looking at the broader picture of the Democrats are going to be looking at kind of, does this have mobilization potential to energize Democratic voters who may otherwise be a little bit disenchanted with the way things are going right now in politics?
You said there are a couple of ways of looking at it. So one way is, yes, it could inspire Democratic voters, or?
Yeah, the other way is maybe doesn't have totally different implications, but I think is really an important kind of conversation about the politics of this that I want to invite the listeners into, which is this question of kind of polarization around the issue of abortion. I think it's very clear that there's a big partisan gap on this, just like there's a big partisan gap on basically every single thing right now. But when you look at various types of polling, it becomes clear that really within both parties, there's kind of a range of opinion. And there's been a debate raging about this in among political scientists for well over a decade about whether Americans are truly polarized on this issue at the kind of mass level of people in the electorate, or if most people fall somewhere in the middle. And 10 years ago, I would have told you that a Supreme Court decision of this magnitude on this issue would have the potential to divide either party. Is anybody's guess? Now I feel like that has changed a little bit, and we've had a number of kind of, you know, high profile anti-abortion Democrats no longer in politics, like Michigan's Bart Stupak. Whereas I feel like one possibility is that with Republicans, given the nature of this decision and what people think the fallout will be, if it becomes a situation in which abortion is completely illegal in a number of states and some of the other kinds of big implications we're seeing, that might actually have the possibility of dividing Republicans, people who are mostly, you know, perhaps say mostly I don't support this, but maybe I see some room for exception. This is the way the issue is currently structured, with those really strong restrictions that are likely to come out of some states. I think that has the potential to be a wedge in that within that coalition, and not so much press at the divisions among Democrats, even though certainly those divisions exist.
I want to spend a little more time on that Pew poll you pointed out toward us. I think it's easy, especially from a vantage point in the media, to think that there's a very strong pro-choice group out there. They would describe themselves as a very strong, self-described pro-life group. One's totally against abortion. One's totally for choice. That poll shows a lot of middle ground and variation and uncertainty in the middle.
Yeah, I think that's essentially what, you know, some political scientists have been kind of advocating for, that perspective in terms of how to understand the polarization around this issue. The other interesting thing about some of the Pew data that's come out over the last couple of months is that Republicans have been very steady on this issue in terms of the percentage who think abortion should be legal in most or some cases. I think it's all or some cases. Whereas Democrats have, this is again kind of voters in the mass electorate, have become more pro-choice over time. I thought that, I don't know how that really will play out in November or you know, in the time in between them, but it is, I think it's kind of interesting as we're thinking about how the parties have kind of coalesced around this issue. I certainly would have told you in the past couple of years, this is a really key issue for devoted Republican activists, and that being able to convey support for the anti-abortion and pro-life position for Donald Trump was really key in consolidating a Republican party that was initially kind of unsure about him in 2016. But at the same time, that is different from the kind of policy change that I think we're kind of looking at potentially, if that draft opinion is at all representative of what the court will eventually decide.
We're talking to Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at Wisconsin's election year, big statewide races for governor and U.S. Senate. We've been talking so far about the potential impact of this potential ruling on Roe v. Wade from the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Does that likely decision affect how you vote? Do you think it will affect the election overall? Call 800-642-1234. Julia, glancing at the primaries for a moment, we've got Republicans lining up to run against Governor Evers. We've got Democrats lining to run up against Senator Johnson. We heard from the latest Marquette University Law School poll from Charles Franklin that the leader, both those races, is don't know. What would it take for candidates to distinguish themselves, you think, and stand out, whether it's on an issue like abortion or otherwise?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I mean, I think it's instructive to think about the fact that a couple of other Midwestern states just had their primaries this week, Indiana and Ohio. And it did, I mean, they have winners, but it also in some ways kind of looked like the winner was still don't know in terms of the decisiveness of some of the big contests. I'm thinking of the sort of three major candidates competing for the Senate nomination in Ohio. I think that this is a tricky time for primaries because the parties are, in terms of their kind of broad stances, there's so little variation. And you do have these issues, you know, as we were just talking about with abortion, where there's a lot of room for these like really complicated and nuanced positions. And a primary election doesn't strike me as really a great venue to hammer out those nuanced details. So candidates have to think about other ways to distinguish themselves and other things to emphasize. And it wouldn't surprise me very much if on the right, on the Republican side, this sort of leads candidates to double down on other types of issues on which they want to distinguish themselves. There already has been some contestation in that Republican gubernatorial primary about the 2020 election and about the kind of lack of the perceived idea that Rebecca Clayfish has a lack of support for Donald Trump's position on the 2020 election that he actually won and won in the state of Wisconsin, a claim for which there is not any evidence, and some Republicans in the state have kind of moved on from that. But that's also a point of weakness for Republicans who've taken that position, and Clayfish is not an exception. On the Democratic side, it seems to me like the interesting thing about that race is it's tightening. And it does seem to be, there does seem to be a possibility that will come down to being kind of like the same dynamics as the 2020 Democratic presidential primary, which is to say all about electability. And that's, I think, going to have a lot to do with name recognition and with the types of claims that these candidates might make about either their potential to win statewide or their records winning statewide, which Godlewski and Barnes both have.
We're talking about the August primary and general elections later this year with Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. Big statewide races for governor and U.S. Senate. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you paying attention to these primary races? What do you want for your party, if you affiliate yourself with the party? What do you want from your candidate for governor or Senate? Are you pulling for the incumbent in either of those races? What issues do you want candidates talking about? What issues do you want us in the media to be talking about over the next few months? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about election year in Wisconsin with Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the races for governor or Senate, the primaries especially, or are you holding off? What issues are important to you? Are there endorsements from current or former presidents of the United States, say, that you're watching for? Call 800-642-1234. And what do you think about this potential overturning of Roe v. Wade and how it could affect the vote, your vote? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller. Isaac is with us in Milwaukee. Isaac, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Isaac?
I just called in because I am planning to turn in a blank ballot for the governor's race in Wisconsin this year.
And why is that?
I think that we have historically low voter turnout rates, and they've only been getting lower, you know, each election with some exceptions, but that's the long-term trend. And I think that that's the case maybe because a lot of the people who don't vote, in a way, are, you know, I hate to say it, but smarter than a lot of us who've been trying to give the Democrats our vote over and over again, you know. And I just say that because I think that we've got two major parties who, you know, are very unpopular, but have still managed anyway to continue running the system. And they're both fighting in very different ways culturally, but they're both fighting for the, you know, the elite and the ultra wealthy and the business class. And I just think that we need a party for workers and the poor and, you know, the bottom half of this country who are working every day and, you know, ultimately making less money.
Isaac, thanks for the call. Julia, there are a lot of people who don't vote, especially in non-presidential elections. Do you think some of them may share Isaac's motivation?
Sure. There's a lot of discussion about why people don't vote. I mean, one interesting thing is that over nationally, over the last couple of election cycles, even though I think a lot of people share Isaac's sentiment that they feel really shut out of the political process, they feel like things haven't gotten better for them. Turnout has actually gotten higher. I think because even though that perception and that widespread sense of dissatisfaction is there, that relative to 20 years ago, the kind of issue differences between the two parties have still been really evident. I guess it depends on what issues and what policy outcomes you care the most about. But turnout has actually gotten higher. That's kind of like a silver lining of party polarization. But I do, you know, I do really hear that dissatisfaction and that sense that no matter who is in office, life has not improved for some people. And you know, I've done some work with one of my graduate students on what people write in kind of open questions on surveys about why they don't trust or have confidence in institutions. And we see a lot of the kinds of comments that Isaac was making about, particularly about political parties. They see this as primarily for the elites, for people with money, and not for them. And I don't have any easy answers or even any difficult ones.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about election year in Wisconsin with Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in with your thoughts about the race for governor, the race for Senate, your hopes, your fears in those races, and whether the Roe v. Wade makes you pay more attention to them. This leaked draft document from the U.S. Supreme Court that indicates maybe overturning Roe v. Wade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julia, as you mentioned, a couple of primary votes have come in now. A lot of people looking at the influence of former President Donald Trump. We have a very small sample size here. What are you looking at when it comes to whether his enthusiastic endorsement makes a difference?
I'm looking at a couple things, and some of them are going to be easier to really get a handle on than others. The one that I think is easier to get a handle on is kind of what kinds of candidates are being endorsed by the former president, and is he endorsing candidates who otherwise, you know, aren't very likely to win? And, it, you know, in the last couple of cycles, Trump has been very strategic about endorsing candidates who are likely to win, which I think really makes, you know, like makes a kind of self-reinforcing cycle where he looks really powerful in the party. When people perceive you to be powerful in the party, you are. So I'm looking for those sorts of endorsements. That did make the Vance endorsement very interesting, the Senate race in Ohio, because it didn't look like J.D. Vance was necessarily going to be a very strong candidate up until fairly close to the election when he was endorsed by the former president. The more complicated issue I'm kind of looking at is the difference between an actual Trump endorsement and a kind of dividing line between candidates who align themselves with Trump and kind of Trumpism, the kind of Trump positions and political style, and the, you know, kind of candidates who are running as an alternative vision within the Republican Party, of which there are, you know, there are a few, including the candidate, the third place finisher in the Ohio Senate primary. So I'm kind of looking at those dynamics, both what is the kind of strength of the alternative position in the Republican Party, but also what is the relative strength of Trump as the person versus Trump as the idea. And that includes looking at candidates who are really trying to take Trumpism to kind of the next level and potentially be competitors to the former president who want to take that vision and kind of run with it. And, you know, like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, I think, is a good example of that. So I'm kind of looking at whether we also have prominent candidates like that who are, I call them interpreters of Trumpism. That might be kind of a clunky phrase, but you all will forgive me.
In a state like Wisconsin now, where, again, don't know, is leading the Republican field for governor, is that a case where you see a Trump endorsement making enough of a marginal difference to help somebody emerge from the pack?
I mean, that one seems unclear. I mean, a somewhat different read. I was looking at the Marquette poll. I was looking at the Real Clear Politics average, and it looks like Clayfish is a pretty strong favorite at this point. Maybe that could obviously change. And these polls didn't even include Michaels. But I do think that if there were, you know, if it becomes close, if it starts to look like the Democratic Senate primary where it starts to tighten, then that's where you might see an endorsement. You might see an endorsement make a difference.
Now, turning to other possible issues, we've talked a little bit about the 2020 election still being in there. Abortion, of course, a big one. You mentioned the economy earlier, and we're going to talk about the economy and all the yes, but on the other hand, things, great job numbers, bad inflation numbers, and you can go back and forth for a while. How do you watch for that asserting itself in these races?
I think the main thing that we've learned over the years is that, you know, the economy tends to be people's number one issue. So the question then is, how do people perceive the economy? And how does that interact with their partisan identification? So like you said, there's this very confusing situation where there's, you know, good jobs numbers, bad overall economic ratings because of perceptions of inflation. I also think there's probably something going on with COVID. People are just kind of grumpy and dissatisfied. I mean, I think everyone has had a rough time the last 2 years. And it's, I think that we don't quite know what a midterm election looks like under those conditions, right? We don't really have a roadmap for that. We also learned in 2020 that the role of the economy seems to be tempered by bipartisanship. And what I mean by that is that if you just looked at the economic numbers and you ran them through the model that political scientists have been using to predict elections, which has been pretty good, Trump massively overperformed. He did much better than you would expect given the state of the economy and in fall 2020. And so, you know, one question there is, are there people who identify as Democrats who might go, grumble, grumble, I am not happy with the economy, I'm not even super happy with Biden, but, you know, fundamentally, this is my identification, my team, my perspective, and vote that way nonetheless. I did see a primary poll, a midterm poll that was sort of reflective of that. Democrats were doing really badly on a bunch of different issues. Republicans were doing badly on some as well. And then it was like, well, who are you thinking to vote for? And it was like 44, 43 Republicans to Democrats, right? Like people have all these ideas about how things are going. And ultimately it comes down to their partisanship.
So briefly, issues may not matter as much anymore.
That's one possibility where, because of the pandemic, because of the level of polarization, because of the unique circumstances of the 2020 election, I think we're a little bit in uncharted territory as far as what we might be able to say about the larger dynamics of this 2020 or 2022 midterm.
Julia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University. We talked with her about this year's election in Wisconsin, how current events, including this week's leaked Supreme Court opinion, potentially overturning Roe v. Wade, could shake things up. Coming up Monday on Central Time, working at customer service jobs can take a lot of draining emotional labor, even in normal times. And the pandemic, well, it made things even more stressful. We'll look at the strain on a huge part of the workforce. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, Milwaukee officials are starting to take childhood trauma into account during criminal sentencing of youth offenders. We'll talk to a reporter who wonders what it would take to break the cycles of violence that get young people to the courtroom in the first place. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up in our weekly edition of Food Friday, we'll get ready for Mother's Day and ways to make a great meal for mom. First, Marlon Dixon was arrested when he was 14 years old for his role in the high-profile murder of a Milwaukee man. When he finished serving his prison sentence, Marlon was 32 years old. He'd spent more than half his life behind bars. Milwaukee County is taking a second look at cases like Marlon's and how young people are sentenced. Some officials say childhood trauma is an important piece of the puzzle that wasn't taken into account in the past. In a new series for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, our next guest looks at trauma, crime, and incarceration of young people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you charged with a crime at a young age? Do you work in the youth justice system yourself? And in general, how do you think youth should be sentenced in Wisconsin? What should be the bar, the line for when younger people are tried and charged as adults? What should be done to help youth who face hardships? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. James Causey is a projects reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab. He's been reporting on Milwaukee since he was in high school. James recently wrote a series called Life Correction, taking a closer look at how childhood trauma runs into the criminal justice system. James, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start where you did, James. How did you get connected with Marlon Dixon?
Well, it's really interesting. I was a O'Brien Fellow at Marquette University, and I received this call from a woman from Denver, Colorado, who said who wanted to know if the name Marlon Dixon rung a bell. And I told her it didn't. And then she asked me if I heard about the Charlie Young Jr. beating case from 2002. And of course, everyone heard about that. Mm-hmm. And she told me that Marlon was the young man who got the most time from that case. And I just couldn't believe anybody was still incarcerated from that case, because most of the people who participated were so young. And she told me that he would be getting out in a year. And she wanted to know if I could connect him to any kind of programs once he get out, once he was released, because she was worried that he would be he would end up back in prison if he didn't have those programs in place or able to find housing and things like that. And I told her I would look out and see what I could do. She gave me his information in prison, and we started communicating. And then she told me, you know, he had a kid, and he was 14 when he was arrested, but he had a 5-month-old. And I just wanted to know what life was like for this 14-year-old being charged as an adult and spending that much time behind bars.
And that brought you to looking at adverse childhood experiences for kids. Can you talk about what Marlon's life had been like growing up?
Oh, yeah. He's the case study for trauma, actually. You know, before he participated in this this beating, his father was stabbed to death outside a methadone clinic by a man who he got into an altercation with. Prior to that, his father was very abusive to him. He beat on him, cursed at him, all kinds of things. And he grew up in a very violent neighborhood where sirens and fighting and shootings and things like that were a constant. And on top of that, you know, the educational system failed him as well. He really couldn't read well. And, you know, by the age of 14, he read at a first or second grade reading level. So he struggled throughout his life. You know, his mother did the best she could raising him and his siblings, but it was just like the streets had a stronger pull than a mother's love at that time.
Now, in talking to Marlon, he did not claim he wasn't responsible for these crimes at the young age of 14. But this started you on a track, James, of looking at how people who grew up in Marlon's situation with so many strikes against them, so many traumas, and how they're treated in the justice system. Where did you go from Marlon's case?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people, when we hear the word trauma, we think that that's something that was always there. Like, you know, trauma is talked about so much. You know, we know our military veterans and people like that have experienced trauma. We also know that, you know, police officers who go to scenes all the time like that experience trauma. But when we talk about childhood trauma, that was a relatively new concept back in 2002 when a beating took place. No one was talking about childhood trauma. And the people who were bringing it up, when it was brought up during this case, they were laughed at. They were told that this didn't exist. They were just, this was the age of the super predator talk. And people were talking about, you know, groups of youth going around preying on people, and these kids were just bad, and they were super predators. So that was the language of that day. So, but now, you know, after 2002, the childhood trauma started to come up more and more around 2004, 2005. And that's where people really started to talk about it more. Unfortunately for Marlon, that wasn't his case. I mean, nobody was talking about it by the time he was sentenced. But what we discovered today and what we know today about how the brain how a child's brain develops, what happens to you as a child has a lot of impacts on what happens to you as an adult. It impacts your emotions. It impacts how you do in school. It impacts how you have relationships. It impacts you your health, your physical health. You know, if you've been traumatized as a kid, though, we've learned that it can have impacts on your heart, your lungs, how you your overall stress levels that causes your cortisol to go up. So it's so many things that we learned about the impact of childhood trauma and how that impacts your body that it's absolutely amazing what we learned. Unfortunately, not enough is being done to address the traumas that our youth are going through on a daily basis. You know, our schools need to have more counselors on hand, and we need to really, really step up how we tackle this issue.
Talking to James Causey, projects reporter from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab, looking at his latest series on trauma and youth incarceration. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest. Maybe your experiences going through, and I hope recovering from trauma as a young person. If you work in the system, the youth justice system somewhere yourself or as a counselor, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. James, you mentioned that idea of the super predator. You quote the guy, the academic who came up with this concept of the irredeemable super predator back, I think in the 80s or 90s. now saying he was wrong. And, you know, it's like these kids need more emotional help. They need hugs as much as anything. What kind of solutions do you see out there that we could use more of to keep a kid from ending up in the criminal justice system in the first place?
Well, you know, honestly, you know, things that really help youth deal with issues of trauma is really being able to see value in themselves. For instance, one part of my series talk with where I talk with our county executive, he would have been a part of this beating case too had he not been evicted, you know, 3 months prior to this whole thing taking place, because he knew the boys involved. He knew Charlie Young Jr. I'm referring to David Crowley. And one thing that he said saved him was the fact that he got involved with a program called Urban Underground, run by Charlene and Reggie Moore. Reggie Moore, he's also ran the Office of Violence Prevention here in Milwaukee. And one thing that they taught the young people how to do is see value in themselves, see value in others. And one thing David Crowley said, it was the first program to teach him how to love and how to love another person. Other things that help, first jobs. You know, David Crowley was able to find a job at the age of 14, cutting grass, working for this lawn service. And his employer was this black man who hired a lot of young people to work and teach them the value of work and how important it is to come to work every day, be on time, and have some level of responsibility. You know, 75 to 80% of our young people today living in very troubled areas can't find work. And so those things really help. But honestly, mentorship is one of the strongest factors that come into play here. You know, and you don't have to have like a medical background, but if you could just talk to a youth who may not, whose father may not be around, or it may have been in an abusive situation, sometimes just talking to a young person and getting them to express how they feel, that goes a long ways too.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Donna is with us in Wauwatosa. Donna, hi.
Hi. I absolutely agree that there has to be a lot of intervention with these families that have a lot of trauma. And I'm not even sure where to begin, but I did want to say this. You said that the educational system failed him because he couldn't read. I spent years working in MPS, and in order to teach kids, they have to show up. And a lot of times these kids didn't show up, or they moved from school to school to school. And, you know, as teachers, we want to teach kids to read. We want to help them, but they have to show up too. I'm just wondering if this young man, you know, wasn't skipping out all the time, if he actually showed up.
Donna, thanks for the call. James, the difficulties a kid like Marlon faced in the school system, can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I could talk a little bit about that. So one thing that I think happened with Marlon, he wasn't a kid who got into a lot of trouble in school, but I think he was a kid who he did have his struggles in, you know, he ran at a second grade level. It was no way in hell he should have been in eighth grade. I mean, he kept getting passed, and that doesn't do anybody any good if you keep passing a kid who can't read, because if this pattern would have continued, imagine him passing 12th grade, reading on the third or fourth grade level. What good does that do for him or society? He can only turn to a couple of things, you know, crime and maybe the illegal drug trade, because if you can't read, that's one of the basic foundations for a lot of things. So I'm not just blaming teachers, but there's something, he fell through the cracks, and someone has to take responsibility for that. Because, I mean, one thing that he told me that was very telling, when he was incarcerated, he tried to write his daughter's mom to tell her, you know, that he cared for her and cared for his daughter, but he couldn't even spell Fond du Lac. So he couldn't even spell the street that she lived on, so he couldn't even write her letters. That's pretty bad.
Donna, thanks for that call. We're talking to James Causey, projects reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab, talking with James about his new series, exploring connections between trauma, youth, and the criminal justice system. You can join in at 800-642-1234. For youth who end up in the criminal justice system, do you think there needs to be more attention to these kind of traumas that may have led a kid there in the first place? Have you encountered this system yourself, maybe as a youth or maybe as someone in the criminal justice system. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with James Causey, projects reporter at the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel, talking with James about his recent series called Life Correction, with a closer look at the role childhood trauma can play in juvenile sentencing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. James, I want to get back to the story of Marlon Dixon, arrested as a teenager. He spent 18 years in prison. You and a fellow reporter Angela Peterson were there the day Marlon was released. Angela captured some of his reflections on that day. Here's a clip from the video that you posted on the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel website.
I'm going to go on and live my life in a way that now I know what it's like to be a part of something like that, to be inside something like that. Now I know what I must do, you know, to make sure that other people never, you know, join in that type of mentality or join into that type of group and to do something like that.
James, you talked earlier, the initial contact you had was about resources for someone like Marlon hoping to start a new life after prison. And as we heard there, hoping to prevent people from doing the same things he had done. What resources are out there?
Yeah, so one thing that I pointed out in my series is that the main resource that people need who are coming out of prison is housing, you know, because a lot of people think, well, they could go back to where they were, you know, but, you know, in the case of Marlon, in the case of a lot of people who have been locked up for decades, people have died, people have moved on, been evicted and things like that. So going in some cases, you can't go back to the same neighborhood that you were living in because, you know, other circumstances come up. You know, he has like 21 things that he can't do or else he'd be violating his parole. Like he can't be living with someone who has a criminal record. And his two of his brothers have criminal records. So he technically can't be around them. And it's a lot of things that he could do to violate his parole. So he has to be very careful and walk on thin ice. And that's why being on this extended supervision for an additional 22 years after he was released is just, it almost sets up people for failure because there's so many things that could be in violation of what he can't do. And one thing that I want to stress too is like I gave Marlon an ACE test. It's a test that determines your childhood trauma when he was incarcerated. It's like 10 questions that really ask basic questions like, have you ever seen your mother abused? Have you been abused? Have you been sexually abused? And it asks a series of 10 questions like that. And he scored an 8 out of 10, which is very high because typically you want to score a 3 or less. And this determines, some people say it could determine how your future ends up, although you know, it's debatable, but when you have more traumas like that happened to you as a child, it's not really a good thing. So, you know, what I really wanted to do is stress that, you know, in order for people who come out of prison, they have to be put on the right path. And housing was a tough issue for him because he went back to live with his mother. He couldn't really stay there. And fortunately for him, he met a young lady and she's like the best thing that happened to him. And they live in Menominee Falls now. Out of a lot of the traumas and a lot of the constant sirens and shootings and things like that he would hear if he was staying where his mother stays.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hey, hi. Thank you for having this program. So I'm a teacher in the Madison School District, and I heard kind of what was said before about, you know, that he slid through the cracks and he's at a second grade level. And we, as teachers, have this happen all the time where we need, like, more support. We see kids all the time with trauma and with that are behind grade level, and there's not enough support. So even, like, right now I've got kids below grade level that I can't meet their needs right now, even though I work on different things with them, and I'll try to get special supports. We don't have, like, the manpower, the people power just in the building, because there's so much more need now. And if we really want to stop this sort of thing from happening, this is where it should be. It should be like in the schools, like more supports for kids with trauma, with kids that are below grade level, because yeah, we're not serving them well if we just keep passing them on. And it's not that the teachers don't know. We want them to get services. We just don't have the ability to give it to them.
Scott, thanks for the call. James.
I feel your pain on that. And I feel the pain of a lot of teachers. And I've heard this as a constant, you know, after this series ran, where teachers felt like they're being blamed in some way for the Marlon Dixons of the world. And that was not the intent of this. I do agree that teachers, you know, bottom line is teachers, everybody knows, everybody has had a good teacher, everybody has had a bad teacher, right? I know the great teachers I have made and formed me who I am today. And I've had some teachers that were just kind of just there. But I know a lot of teachers are very passionate about their kids. They're passionate about what they do, and they love their kids. Unfortunately, they can't do it all. And that's where I think these schools need to become educational centers, where not only where they educate the students, but they need to educate families. You know, Marlon's mother was overwhelmed. His father was a high school dropout. So, you know, maybe we need to look at education in a different way. And all this stimulus money that came in, I want to see these educational institutions, these schools, do something with this funding to address and help teachers do the most that they can, because teachers can't do it alone. I've been in schools where I've seen, you know, 30 kids in a classroom and a teacher not even having a paralegal trying to do it by themselves. That's impossible. Even with some of the best students, it's almost impossible. So teachers do need the support, and we got to figure out a way to give them that support.
Thanks a lot for that call, Scott, at 800-642-1234. Talking to James Causey from the Journal Sentinel about his new piece on youth trauma and the criminal justice system. Time for one more caller. Heidi is with us in Dunn County. Hi, Heidi, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for this topic. I am a trauma specialist, and even for me to call in being in private practice, it's actually difficult for me because there's so many community members who frown upon youth who have been incarcerated, who are coming out of incarceration, whether coming out of day treatments and service centers. And I believe that especially our court system, probation officers, a lot of mental health services, a lot of our schools, they don't know what to do and how to help treat these youth. And they believe that these are bad kids and I don't necessarily want them around me when they get out, rather than stepping out and saying, hey, let's give this person a try. What services can we do to advocate? And I just wonder if maybe you have any further resources on what we can do to...
Heidi, I'm going to jump in because we're just about out of time. James, just in our last minute, you looked at what Milwaukee County is doing. Briefly, are some of those attitudes changing that Heidi is worried about?
Yeah, the attitudes are changing, but they're not changing fast enough. And that needs to improve. I mean, there's programs out there, but you know, a lot of these programs suffered greatly during the COVID pandemic, you know, where they were there before the pandemic happened, where they could have helped people. But Marlon was released during the pandemic, right in the heart of the pandemic. And so a lot of the programs that could have been there to assist him were shuttered, and they couldn't provide any services for him. So what we need to do is, like, now that we're coming out of this pandemic, those programs need to be beefed up and backed financially so that they can help more people. But it's still not enough, even if we fully fund most of these programs that are trying to do the work. So we need to make a complete change in order to help the Marlon Dixons of the world. Or else, if we don't help them, guess what? We're just going to keep this cycle going. He's going to end up back in the system, and we're just going to keep this cycle going. And I don't think anybody wants that.
James, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
James Causey writes from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Ideas Lab. We talked with him about a series called Life Corrections, looking at childhood trauma and criminal sentencing. You can find a link to that series on our website at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we help you get ready for Mother's Day on today's edition of Food Friday with brunch recipes and tips for treating mom. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.